This is the Sonya Poulton Show on today's News Talk TNT.
Hello and welcome to the Sonya Poulton Show on today's News Talk TNT. How the divil are you today? How are you all doing? I'm just having a good look around at all of the platforms where you can find TNT today. Happy Friday, Mazzy. Happy Friday to you too, Brett and Chris and Lozzie. How wonderful to see you all. And good morning, Craig O'Bath in the comments. Absolutely wonderful to see you all on this Friday. Now, yesterday, in front of approximately 14 or 15 MPs who bothered to turn up, MP Andrew Bridgen held his excess death debate in the British Parliament. He started by saying, "We are witnesses to the greatest ever medical scandal in living memory." And he's right, although from the outrageous lack of interest from MPs to media, you wouldn't know it. Mr. Bridgen talks about how the novel and untested C19 jab was a large part of the problem. He dismissed that he was that fabled creature, the anti-vaxxer, and pointed out that he had been double jabbed. He even promoted it, and he was now vaccine injured. He pointed out quite correctly that intelligent people should be able to tell the difference when those of us are simply questioning a product that not only doesn't work how they told us it will work, but has caused serious harm and even death to some people. He was critical of the influence of parliamentary whips and groupthink, and he said that this debate was going to be the subject of serious scrutiny by future generations. And I have to agree with him. The fact is, Parliament is hugely complicit in this scandal. No wonder the chamber was all but empty yesterday. The fact is, as Mr. Bridgen points out, there are people in Parliament and around Parliament and who informed COVID and the jabs policy on a national level. And there are people and organisations who have hid key data in order to be able to carry out the mass jab programme. On this, he was referring to the Office for National Statistics, who have now changed how they gather and release data around this issue. I've talked with doctors on this show, and they see absolutely no reason for it except, well, for a form of smoke and mirrors when it comes to the issue of excess deaths. The old calculation method has been sent packing, and it would appear because it was unhelpful for the powers that be. As one example, Mr. Bridgen pointed out that 20,000 excess deaths have been airbrushed away from the figures for 2023. He referred to the Do Not Resuscitate Orders, aka DNR, and about the document that was circulated to doctors and hospitals in March 2020 and was supposed to be guidance, but it was taken as policy and it resulted in people literally being allowed to die because the NHS and the people working in it deemed them no longer worthy of saving. Yes, that happened. I've talked with people who watched as their loved ones slipped away and they were watching them on iPad. And he also points out that this happened as medical staff performed dances on TikTok. What happened to us? How do we lose our humanity during C19 that we allowed the psychopaths who run our establishment to put so many people to death? And to continue that by coercing, bullying and part mandating some of our citizens to take a jab that had not been put through the normal vaccine procedure and for which I have personally talked with many whistleblowers about the negligence of these gene therapy jabs. The fact is that period was extremely dark. There were excessive amounts of midazolam and morphine ordered and administered to elderly people. We treated our vulnerable and sick as if they didn't matter, as if they were useless eaters to be done with to save and protect younger, healthier people, as if some of us are more worthy than others. Everyone involved, from the then Prime Minister Boris Johnson and Health Secretary Matt Hancock, are culpable for this. Every single leader, from Rishi Sunak to Keir Starmer, they all promoted it. They all supported it. Every government appointed scientist who turned out to have shares and interests in private healthcare companies and big pharmaceuticals. The system is rotten. The jabs were never safe and effective, but it didn't matter because the government gave the companies immunity anyway. And like the British public, who were thrown to the wolves and every heart attack thereafter blamed on everything from not sleeping in the correct position to having hay fever. Mr. Bridgen ended his speech by calling for immediate suspension of the mRNA jabs for both humans and animals and pending an outcome. It was at this point that the public gallery absolutely erupted with cheers, and the Madam Deputy Speaker said, "No, no, no, no," which just about sums up Parliament's approach to hearing about excess deaths. And let us look at what the question of the day is today. Well, this is interesting. Rishi Sunak has vowed to put an end to the sick note culture in Britain by ending the right of GPs to sign people off work. We want to know what makes you sick of work. What's the very worst thing about your job? And you can call us, and you can call us. Here are the numbers.
This is the way we're going to be heard.
From the U.S. and Canada, call 1-888-201-6425. From the U.K., call 033-0024-1026. And from Australia and New Zealand, call 1-800-670-310. Free speech is alive and well on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
So please do call us, and if we have an opportunity, we'll get you to the phone lines and let's have a good conversation. And let us welcome in for the last day of the week our wonderful Gemma Cooper. Good morning to you, Gemma.
Oh, just listening to all that, Sonia, just sends a chill down your spine, you know, lest we forget. And I'm so glad that there were so many in the public gallery yesterday to show Parliament what the people think and what the people know, you know, to show our so-called leaders. I mean, I can't even say that word. You know, it just never, ever let it be thrown down the memory hole of 1984. Never. We've got work to do, people. Andrew Bridgen's doing it. Whatever your opinion of him, maybe personally, at least somebody is standing up in those halls of oh God, corruption, and saying the truth. And so well done to everybody who made the trip to London. I know that before, when there have been public debates, people have travelled, the WHO pandemic treaty, people travelled for that one. Well, that wasn't in the Commons, that was in a chamber. But still, if you travel, if you take the day off work to stand up for what is right, what you know is right, good for you. Good for you. You know, and we'll back you all the way here on TNT. And good for Andrew Bridgen. You know, he's lost a lot, but he's gained a lot. In another way.
I mean, I have to agree with you, Gemma. There obviously is a lot of criticism about him, and I've been critical of Andrew as well, but there's no doubting that he is actually raising an issue that all the MPs want to pretend isn't happening. So we have to give him kudos for that, don't we?
We do. And I think as well, the way the establishment is behaving is it is showing its hand. Just before I get onto the headlines of a Friday here in the UK, you know, the very fact that the COVID inquiry has suspended the vaccine element of looking at the, you know, inquiring and looking at the vaccine rollout, vaccine harms, they've suspended that. And then they said they weren't going to look at the harms of lockdown. So the third and fourth stages, they've just been postponed. And then the Office for National Statistics suddenly magically deciding it was going to recalibrate the way it looked at deaths. It's showing us that it knows, the system knows, we know it knows that we know, you know, it's this game of cat and mouse. And all I know is that everywhere I go now, where once I was regarded 4 years ago, 3 years ago, as an absolute nutter and had a very high profile public hanging for challenging what was going on. Now, everywhere I go, went to pick up my dry cleaning the other day, ended up with the owner of the dry cleaners, small family business, telling me how evil the jabs were, how he's told all his friends not to have them, and how one of his best mates died of a heart attack. Everywhere, people know this. Everywhere. So we all got to gather together, stick together, support each other, speak out, don't be afraid. This is how we win.
Absolutely. And so say all of us. What's happening with the UK today, Gemma?
Well, the biggest headline is, of course, it's funny, it's a Friday, you know, just as we're heading into the weekend of hopefully leisure and pleasure and some nice sunshine across the UK. Rishi Sunak's done talking about work. He's going to make this landmark speech today about clamping down on the welfare bill, on long-term sick. He wants to get people back into work. There's a lot of people since the scamdemic, they don't want to go back to work. A lot of people say anxiety and depression is the main reason. And he's saying, no, enough's enough. And he's going to strip GPs of their powers to sign people off sick. That's a big thing. I think we'll go into that in a minute. The husband of Scotland's former First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, has been charged with embezzling party funds when she was the leader. A police investigation into the party funding has been going on for several months, and he was arrested yesterday and released last night. He's since gone home. And police have confirmed they're now looking into claims into a story we first reported yesterday here on TNT about the Conservative Party MP Mark Mingus, who's an MP in the northwest of England. His campaign aide says that he allegedly phoned her at 3 a.m. demanding £5,000 to pay off some bad people. Police are now looking into that. The aide that made the claims is now speaking out herself. She says she's appalled at the Conservative Party. She reported what happened straight away. They promised an investigation straight away. She says they did nothing. She's lost complete faith in the Conservative Party. So that's a story to watch with interest. A lot of politicians in quite a bit of trouble at the moment, Sonia.
And I think we have to look at the Rishi story. Of course, we also will be looking at that with our news reviewer later. But Gemma, I always appreciate your take on top stories like this. Tell us more.
Well, I'm in mixed feelings about this because I can kind of understand why people don't want to work. When you think about what work is, and it'd be interesting to see the responses that you get in the phone in. But work is really a very sophisticated kind of form of slavery. You know, you don't get a lot of choice about it. You have to spend a certain 16 to 64 year old of working age, and 2.8 million people of those 3 million people are on long term sick. It was 2.1 before the scamdemic, now 2.8. That's a significant jump. So you have to ask, you know, what was the long term knock on effect of the pandemic and the way that it affected the country's mental health? And they don't want to go back to work. 53% of those people often long-term sick, it's depression, anxiety. And he says it's holding the economy back. It's about the economy. It's not about people. And it's a key, going to be now a key issue in the election, and politicians must do more and not be afraid, he says, to tackle this issue. So a landmark speech coming later. I don't know if it will have an effect. You can take a horse to water, possibly, by stripping GPs of the power to say, I'm sorry, I can't sign you off sick. You have to get a job. But if you're not in the mood to work, everybody knows what it's like in the office. If you've got a few people that aren't in the mood, the work doesn't get done. So how do you solve this problem, which is malaise and dissatisfaction with the system, possibly, even if you do get people back into a working environment? And I do wonder what the GPs will say about mental health issues, which do prevent them from going into the workplace. It'd be interesting to see the reaction from the medical establishment, I think.
So, Gemma, this is interesting because you obviously raise up another issue, and that is, what impact has the last 4 years had on people's mental health? Well, as you reported last week, we won't know because the COVID-19 inquiry won't be looking into that aspect of it. How damn convenient of what is going on here. Something very, very wrong. This is terrible. This is literally taking something so integral out of the hands of the very people who actually have a better understanding of it. Politicians are not doctors. They don't understand. And I'm quite shocked by this story. So I'm glad that we're really going into it on this show today, because I think this is absolutely appalling. The state literally wants to take over everything, Gemma. Literally everything.
It does. And I think the key thing is in the top sort of lines of his desire to bring people back into the workplace, and enough is enough, is that, you know, it's holding the economy back. Well, of course, you know, the thing is about the way our economy runs here in the West, and in Britain especially, is the working generation pay for the retired generation. So this ties in very nicely, unfortunately, with what you said about, you know, what happened in the scamdemic about bumping old people off because there's not enough young people in work to pay for them. That, you know, this is what this is about. There is not enough money going around now for pensions, for benefits, and they're paltry as it is. And also the taxes that are going to fund wars. This is what he means by holding the economy back. We want the money. We need the money. We need to give it to Ukraine. We need to give it to the Middle East. We need to give it, you know, for crazy schemes and, you know, HS2 that never worked. It's our money. And if nobody's working, there's no money going into the coffers. That's what they mean by that, holding the economy back. It's holding us back from being able to do what we want with your cash and your energy. But yeah, this is an encroachment. And the medical establishment, I mean, the BMJ might have something to say about this, or the BMA as well, British Medical Association and GPs councils, all kinds of things, because they see the real effect of this in their surgeries. They see people in tears. But 53% with severe depression and anxiety, you get those people back into the workplace dragging, kicking and screaming. They're not necessarily capable of doing maybe some of the jobs they're asked to do, you know, especially front facing ones with members of the public. So he can say this. Whether it works is another issue. But you're quite right. It's an encroachment of the state into our lives, not for our benefit, of course, but for theirs. And many people I've seen since the figures came out, I think it was last week, Sick Note Culture, or earlier this week, actually, the Sick Note Culture headlines. There was a lot of comment and analysis, and a few people who are on long-term sick or claiming benefits were speaking about it and saying, why would anybody work? I have a great day. You know, I pull in this amount of money. I go to the park. I see my friends. I relax. I enjoy my life. This is what life is all about. And there is an argument for that. Working, who invented it? Who invented a 5-day week? you know, as being the benchmark. There is a lot to be said for questioning the ethos of work and how much time we spend there. Death, the top one, you know, second deathbed revelation after I wish I'd been true to myself and led the life I wanted. What is I wish I hadn't worked so hard. Australian nurse, Bonnie Ware, palliative care. She wrote that book, Top Five Regrets of the Dying. Wish I hadn't spent so much time at work. So there we go. You know, what is work? Let's see what people say on the phone in.
I hear you. Thank you so much, Gemma. We will be right back.
TNT's David Curtin.
I really don't think that they've thought this through, because say you get to the year, okay, 2040, and anyone who's under 31 will not be allowed to buy cigarettes, and anyone who's over 31 will be allowed to. How is that going to be enforced? Will the shops require ID from 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds and 40-year-olds in the future to see whether they're allowed to purchase tobacco products or not? At the moment, there's no issue, as I say, but in the future, it's going to be completely ridiculous. I don't think that shops will want to do that. It will be essentially unenforceable.
David Curtin on today's News Talk, TNT.
As a combat wounded veteran, I know how hard it is to come home and build a meaningful life. When I was in Iraq, our vehicle was hit. A rocket-propelled grenade exploded right under my seat. Traumatic brain injury, a fractured pelvis, severe burns. They didn't think I was gonna make it. I had to learn to walk again and live with the scars, both visible and invisible.
DAV helps veterans like LaToya get the benefits they've earned. They help more than a million veterans every year in life-changing ways.
With DAV on my side, I was able to pursue my dreams. If my story can touch a heart, it can change a life. My victory is overcoming my wounds so I can help other veterans.
LaToya Lucas, may your victories inspire many more. Support more victories for veterans. Go to DAV.org.
We don't rock. We talk. Today's News Talk. TNT Radio.
And welcome back. And I believe I have a caller on the line. Good morning, James. Are you there?
Hello, Sonia. Yes.
Well, thank you for joining us this morning. Do tell us, you've had a problem. The NHS keeping you ill?
Yes. Yes, for my entire adulthood. Yes, I have an orthodontic condition. From an operation when I was 10 years old, but orthodontic conditions are not recognised in adults. Therefore, my medical condition has been ignored the whole of my adult life. Even when I was waking up paralysed in my early 30s, that was the worst it got. So I'm being kept ill totally unnecessarily, and I'd like the operation so I can get out and have a life, and that includes work.
Yeah, absolutely. I hear you. So, what does your own GP have to say about this?
Well, he's very supportive of me, but doctors are not allowed to have any decisions over my dental condition, my orthodontic condition, which has twisted my skull, twisted my spine when I was 22. And it got worse and worse, and then I was waking up paralysed, and for the whole of the time, I'm being medically completely ignored and starving.
This is scandalous, absolutely scandalous. You are not the first person to tell me about problems with orthodontic care in adults. And in fact, I've been researching a piece for this show, James. It might be something that we can get you to contribute to, because this is clearly a scandal. You need to be taken care of. People need to be taken care of. This is exactly why we pay our taxes. And I'm really sorry to hear what you've been enduring. But if we can get your details, I'm sure the team will, then we would like to get you involved in contributing to a longer piece about this issue. You up for that?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you.
Excellent. Listen, take good care of yourself, James. Thank you very much for joining us this morning, and we will be in touch with you. Take good care of yourself. Right, that's a fairly shocking story, everybody, isn't it? It's outrageous. People aren't being taken care of. This poor man, he's struggling, and like he says, I want to work. So anyway, right, Jack, Good morning, Jack David. We're having a bit of a morning here. I am joined, delighted to be joined by a regular political commentator who joins us regularly on the Sonia Poulton Show. Good morning, Jack.
Good morning. You okay?
I'm great, thank you. It's been just over a week, of course, since the publication of the groundbreaking CAS review, but its reverberations are still being felt, right? And as one example, of course, yesterday, the Sandiford Clinic in Scotland, also known as the Tartan Tavistock, said that it would be no longer prescribing puberty blockers to those under 18. I can't actually believe that turnaround. What are your thoughts?
Well, the initial reaction from Scotland was that they would go the complete opposite way around. But, you know, things have moved fast, which is for the good. These drugs, they're not reversible. You know, we've got the proof of that now. The hysteria coming from the Green Party in Scotland is just beyond all jokes. I don't know if you've seen them on Twitter. They need to go. They need to go. We can't have these drugs going into kids any longer. And I'm hoping that this pause is really means pausing on the way to blocking them completely, because there's no need for them whatsoever.
Do you think this will be something of an embarrassment for the SNP, who have been absolutely spearheading this agenda from the get-go?
They just seem to dig in deeper, don't they? So, you know, they had the vote the other day and it was all Green and SNP that voted, you know, for keeping gender-affirming care. They just seem to, they seem so far into it now that there's no escape back from it. But what do they want us to do? Do they want us to just wait 20 years down the line to see if they were right after all? Because there's a whole generation of kids at stake here with that.
So, I mean, Jack, you and I have talked at length about this. This is a level of madness that is taking place. And you are a gay man and you have been fairly horrified, because none of this actually assists LGB people, does it?
No, we're being force teamed into something that's got something, you know, it's got nothing to do with us whatsoever. There's nothing, there's no similarities between a same-sex attracted person and someone who thinks they're born in the wrong body. But we're force teamed into everything, into this one big club, and we're expected to all be happy about it. Now, I was saying yesterday, I'm not a pet that you introduce to something new and train to live with it. You know, I've got my own mind, and you're not just force teaming me into something I don't want to be involved in. And the reality is with this, these kids that are going for these drugs, the vast majority of these kids are same-sex attracted. Most of them are on the autistic spectrum. You know, we've gone from a society where we take extreme caution before we put anything to market to now just experimenting on people. Now, this is a generation of kids we're wiping out here. It's literally gay conversion 2.0 at this stage.
I mean, that is actually a shocking statement, but it's sadly true. That is the reality. We had Sharon Davis on with us a couple of days ago, and she was talking about the continued fight to keep men out of women's sports and the problems attached to it. But that force teaming that you talk about, that appears still in Scotland, that appears still to be going on. Primary schools there. LGBT Youth Scotland charity has now got involved with schools. There will be LGBT champions appointed at these schools. They say some as young as four. What on earth is going on, Jack?
Well, I know we're in the 2020s, but have you heard of anything so ridiculous in your life? I mean, as a gay man, I can categorically tell you that at 4 years of age, you know nothing about it whatsoever. And from my own experience of having a four-year-old niece, she's not five till the end of this year, she would have no clue what I was going on about if I went and asked her what a lesbian was right now, let alone going on to, you know, ask other kids in her class and explain what that is and in some way comfort them with it. But this constant sexualizing of kids has to stop. You know, kids as young as four should not be instructed by their teachers to go and ask kids in the class if they're gay, lesbian or trans. It's ludicrous. And in fact, does any kid need to know anything about this whatsoever at all? You know, we never used to have any sort of sex education until we got to high school, not that long ago. And now we're teaching kids, you know, about sexuality and gender as young as four. I've had my suspicions for a long time with this now, this constant push for kids to be able to consent to things that they're simply not old enough to consent to. And, you know, nefarious predators tend to hide in plain sight. And it makes me wonder what they're going to be pushing for consent, what they can consent to next, what they're going to be pushing for next.
I mean, you're absolutely right. And of course, young minds, they're very pliable, aren't they? They can be, you know, manipulated. And that is the deep concern. If I was a parent, I would have a real issue. And I raised my daughter with an absolute understanding about equality for people who are same-sex attracted. But again, I completely agree with you, very young. And what we're hearing is LGBT Youth Scotland will be training the teachers. They will have templates for children who want to change gender. And they will mark things like Transgender Day of Remembrance. Well, you and I know that Transgender Day of Remembrance actually is hardly marking anybody because they're one of the safest demographics in the UK.
And not just that, we seem to have a Remembrance Day every day of the week, it feels like. There's at least once a month, isn't it, at the moment? But we're just creating a problem that isn't there. It's confusing kids. It's a waste of money. And most importantly, you know, following the recent release of the CAST review, it's clear that gender ideology in schools around impressionable children is dangerous. It's no coincidence the amount of kids identifying as trans has ballooned, and it's nothing to do with being more socially acceptable. It's everything to do with the social contagion and it's got way out of hand. But when it's being pushed onto kids from a young age, it's like I said to you last time, there's a lot of gay lads that grow up that get horrendously bullied for it, and their one wish at that point is, it would just be easier for me to be a girl. I know lads in the 40s that think like that now, and they said if they'd have been around at this time, they could have been quite easily pushed down this route. So you are preying on impressionable kids that, you know, what teenager does feel right in their body? I didn't particularly like spotty shoulders and a squeaky voice that just broke out all over the place. But, you know, it's a rite of passage. Puberty is a human right, and no one's got the right to block it.
Absolutely. I love that. Clear as a bell. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, everybody. Jack David, political and social commentator. Doesn't he talk a lot of sense? We'll be right back.
I got news.
News.
I got news for you.
News. News.
I got news. I got news.
TNT Radio News.
Matt Boyland here with your TNT headlines. Israel has launched a limited strike against Iran in response to its retaliatory airstrikes over the weekend. The Bank of America is warning a direct war between Israel and Iran could send oil prices soaring to $130 a barrel. Over 100 university students protesting Israel's war in Gaza have been arrested in dramatic scenes at a campus in New York. And South America's Argentina has applied to become a new global partner of NATO.
Globalist agendas, democratic rights at risk, corruption, propaganda. It never stops. For the news and views silenced by the mainstream media, by government and corporations, vote one. TNT Radio. Free speech always has a home here. Stay up to date with the latest live news and current affairs delivered by our lineup of expert commentators and hosts. Listen to TNT Radio anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
Well, as expected, the comments are coming in thick and fast. Lord Melbury says it's about breaking down society. Chris Smith said, no way I'd send my kids to school. I worry about my grandchildren. Hope, love and peace. Says it's truly evil. And El Cid said, targeting kids before teenagers equals evil. So I think that we can all agree that our viewers are not happy about four-year-olds being told about LGBTQ issues in Scotland. And so say all of us. And it isn't because we're big. I'm certainly not. I've been marching for Stonewall for a very long time, although not in recent years. Now, more on that story that I mentioned yesterday, and that is about the government's plans to snoop into your bank account. The Data Protection and Digital Information Bill will give the Department for Work and Pensions the right to demand account information from banks regarding claimants and that of connected bank accounts, such as landlords, family members, partners or ex-partners. Joining me with his thoughts on this policy is Alan Miller from the Together Declaration. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Sonia.
Thank you for joining us. Tell us, what are your thoughts on this policy? And please make it clean because it's only 8:33 in the morning.
Well, I think the thing is that what we tend to see increasingly is a situation where the people that are running things, and no matter what kind of colour the party is, they're technocrats, and they always tend to think that more laws and more rules and more restriction or impositions are the way forward. So rather a discussion that's democratic about costs and benefits or an assessment and evaluation, Things are never done in that way. And also the public are not put first. Now, their argument at the Department for Work and Pensions are saying that Big Brother Watch, who've commissioned this report, and it's a very good report, so good on them, are overstepping the mark in their concerns. They're saying these things are really just about fraud. It gives the ability to clamp down on those that are fraudulently claiming. And, you know, that will have people will have some sympathy with that, right? With that argument that there are people perhaps getting too much benefits. There's a discussion about a society, an entitled society. If we step back from everything, there's a couple of things. There's one, there's the merit of that argument, right? And then there's a second thing. So the first, the merit about that argument, the issue is that this is very broad, and everything from people's medical information to their opinions, to their movements, not just for them, but as you read out in the introduction, to their spouses or partners, there's a whole range of privacy rights that can be breached, as well as our individual rights around freedom of expression, association. They are fundamental and paramount. And even if it is not intended, and this is important, right? Sometimes intention, it's not necessarily that there's some people going, oh, the Department of Work, right, what we're going to do is we're going to like make sure we control absolutely everyone. That might not be their intention. But you see, once you start implementing these measures and these laws and rules, then you end up having a situation where this can happen. And we've seen already, haven't we, Sonia, that debanking and deplatforming of people, we know obviously very famously with Nigel Farage, but a whole host of people who have had their bank accounts shut, who can't open bank accounts based on their opinions, based on not doing things like ESG a range of other things that don't fit the criteria that currently is the new ideology. The other question about all of this is, why is it that this government, and also almost all in opposition, right, don't seem to have a plan to have productivity and development, and that there's so much around benefits? We've got millions of people on benefits at the moment, partly because you can make it more, you make less money working than you do on benefits for some people. And we've got a real problem.
This is key. This is literally key. They're not tackling the real issues. The fact is that many people are struggling to make ends meet in working jobs. That is the reality. Some people are doing two and three jobs, Alan, and we're constantly targeting people who are literally trying to make the ends meet, right? We're not going to be snooping in, you know, bank executives' accounts or MPs, you know, who are frivolously using our money. And it's always the more vulnerable people, isn't it? And rather than create a productive society, it's about targeting and attacking. Don't you think it's interesting that it's coming at a time when we're being told that Rishi Sunak is going to be removing GPs from signing people off sick? It all seems quite curious, doesn't it? Like an attack on people on benefits.
Well, all round, there's a problem, which is that we're not providing services properly. So you've got a situation where we could do, if we had proper productivity, if we had wealth creation, if we had an investment in infrastructure, but you'd have to be honest, you'd have to say, this might be painful for a while. We need to address the housing crisis. We need to build 5 million new houses, not just nice flats for some people who've got a lot of money, right, but for houses for families that are affordable, which means some people's houses will go down in price potentially because there's more supply. All these things, right? But there's a nervousness about addressing proper infrastructure. Where are our reservoirs? Why are we importing energy? Why are we not investing? Then it goes to the net zero question. And all along the line, we see, well, the solution is more restriction, more surveillance, a bit more digital. So now we've got, and, you know, look, we've already got passports. So they're doing digital passports, biometrics. You could say, well, at borders, you've always had to do that. But all of this starts seeping in, right? We've had the discussion about gymnasiums, we've had the discussion about shopping centers. And across the board, it's this potential. And this is the issue with civil liberties and with freedoms, our liberty, hard-won freedoms and liberties that many, you know, we stand on the shoulders of people who fought and died for this, not just in the Second World War, but for many generations, right? Brutal. If the history of Britain, of people who stood up for free speech and free association, they gave their lives to it. And now we've got a situation where there's an encroachment in a lot of areas, and even where it isn't intended, it's not like it would be wrong, I think, to say, I mean, there are some people who would like this, but it's not per se that people want to say, we just want to make it like some countries, right? Well, you're not allowed to say anything, do anything. But the upshot of some of these measures means we see a similar trend. And that's why this is an important report. And I think that what we need to do is get as many people in the public engaged in calls to action,
right,
and saying freedom of speech and saying our liberties and holding everyone accountable. Because, you know, see what happens, right, Sonia? People say, well, I'm for free speech, but then what happens is, or if I'm against digital ID, but people say, yeah, but it will really help with the small boats or with immigration. Right. All right. On that one instance, I might go for it. And you have this kind of slippery slope that people say, well, yeah, I'm sort of for it for when I agree with it. And I think we have to hold up the thing for a principle that if you allow encroachments for any reason around any issue, then we all become, everything becomes lessened in our freedom and democracy. And that's why
100%. We have to push back, don't we, Al? I mean, that's exactly why you came to be, not you personally, obviously, your organisation, because pushback is vital. And that is a reality. But given the illegality of this, the very idea of snooping in somebody's bank accounts, and of course, in the Netherlands, what happened, I think it was in 2022, there was over 20,000 families who were wrongly targeted for this kind of action because they were already snooping in the bank accounts there. People were left destitute. And that is going to create a hellish situation in its own right. But in reality, can you actually see this being enabled to, you know, allowed to happen?
Well, I think the thing is, it's good that there's pushback and there's been some concern at the Department of Work and Pensions, and they've been a bit defensive about the whole thing. And that's good. They should be. And they need to go back to the drawing board. We should all keep pushing and insisting. Togetherdeclaration.org, if people come to us, you can see how ways that we encourage people to write to their MPs, to write to some of these companies and organisations. We've had a lot of successes around areas in transport, in digital ID, on cash, on a range of areas. But this is an ongoing thing. It's a bit like free speech. These discussions have been going on for 200 years, that you don't just win them forever, right? You have to stay vigilant. We have to keep, because there are some people that think public are just untrustworthy and should be just shut up and put in pens. And the fight for freedom, the flame of liberty, is something that we all have to keep alive, right? Otherwise, you end up being in a situation where it's not, and it's encroached, because some people think, well, this is, it's very easy to look strong and bold by saying we're going to do these measures. We need to put the public at the front of things and the heart of it and say to technocrats, you know, you might agree these things. It sounds all good at Davos or at different places you go and talk. Mm-hmm. But right here at home, we've got serious issues. We've got economic issues. We do need to resolve them. This is not the way to do it. The way to do it is to say, what's our plan for the economy? What's our plan for the next 100 years for innovation, for, you know, curating proper energy solutions, housing, IT across the board for everyone, and make Britain a place that can be part of the future like it was in the 19th century and the start of the 20th century. That's what we really should be doing. And then the whole concern about people generally have never really historically wanted handouts, right? Working people were very proud. You know, and now we've got a situation that it's really problematic, that you it's very difficult to make money in Britain unless you're earning super if you're in the city. But because so much is taken out and then the money is spent on this whole blobby thing of so many things that most people don't agree with. And we need to, and that's another thing about Together, we've got a cabinet and we're saying these are the things that need to happen across the board. We've got issues with our civil servants, with the amount of kind of not the frontline workers in the NHS, but the amount of management and the amount of ideological stuff, the amount of people that are in the way of efficiency and productivity. These are all issues we have to tackle. It might sound better to say, oh, we're going to do this thing on fraud and we're going to use technology, but we need to get underneath it all and say we've got to do it a different way.
Preach, Alan, preach on this Friday morning. We hear you loud and clear. This is exactly what we want. Bring it. Bring it on. Absolutely. Let's fight back, people. Everybody, this is Alan Miller, co-founder of the Together Declaration. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, Alan. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Susan Lucci. I never thought about heart disease until I had my own heart event. At first, like so many other women out there, I ignored my symptoms. A slight pressure on my chest, shortness of breath. I thought, I don't have time to be sick. I had a 90% blockage in my main artery and a 75% blockage in the adjacent artery. I received two stents in my arteries. Stents developed through research funded by the American Heart Association. Those stents saved my life. I'm so grateful to the American Heart Association. Their research helped save my life. I can enjoy life with my children, my grandchildren, and my friends. Please, Listen to your heart. The only reason I'm here today is because I did. Learn more about the American Heart Association's life-saving work at helpheart.org.
Qué color. Perfecto, amigo.
Gracias. Thank you.
What's wrong, mijo?
Donating to a pet's medical care is one of the many ways you can help families in your community. Pets and people belong together. Learn more at petsandpeopletogether.org.
You're with Sonia Poulton on today's News Talk, TNT.
And welcome back. Everybody's very passionate this morning, and I love it. Now, joining me for a roundup of some of the day's big stories is political commentator and property expert, Russell Quirk. Good morning to you, Russell.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Great to have you with us. Now, one story we want to discuss with you is, we're putting your property hat on, is the fact that an estimated 830,000 renters were forced to move home against their will in the last 12 months, with renters forking out approximately $669 on average in unrecoverable costs. With our obsession with owning property, have we forgotten the rights of those renting?
Well, there's a huge backdrop to this. So this is what's known as the Renter Reform Act. So look, at last, and not before time, government are now playing around with the rules and regs with regard to tenants versus landlords. For years and years and years, there's been a thing here in Britain called the AST, the Assured Shorthold Tenancy Agreement, which effectively is a 12-month contract between landlord and tenant. And inarguably, it's weak. It's not enough. But what it's actually converted to, by way of course, our politicians getting involved, Sonia, which is always perilous when it comes to grabbing a few headlines, it's become a thing called unfair evictions. Now, what that alludes to, the perception, therefore, is that, you know, people are moving into a property and 8 weeks later, the landlord's saying, I don't want you in there anymore, Mr. and Mrs. Smith and your kids, off you go. And they're being thrown out on the street. You know, you have this thing in your head, this perception that, you know, poor Mr. and Mrs. Smith are on the street with their bags around them, kind of waiting for a bus to take them somewhere else. That simply isn't true. The reality is that once you're in an assured shorthold tenancy agreement of 12 months or whatever it might be, generally 12 months as maximum, you are secure. You cannot be evicted, of course, unless you either display antisocial behaviour or indeed you don't pay the rent. So people being thrown out and they're therefore being forced moves and costs associated with it, there's a lot of, not on your part, I might add, there's a lot of journalistic licence there, a lot of hyperbole. Now, what the government have started to do, actually 3 or 4 years ago, is to introduce the Rent Reform Act, which is designed to give tenants more rights and security. This thing has been bounced around, I mean, for months and months and months, between lobbyists and the House of Commons and so on, to try and get the balance right between not just tenant rights, and of course, tenants must have security of tenure, they must be looked after. But of course, you've got to be careful you don't go too far, because if you say to landlords, effectively, look, these people are going to move into your property. They're never going to move out. You can't make them move out, and they're never going to pay an increase in rent. That sounds great if you're a lobbyist for tenants' rights, or you know, someone like Shelter, Polly Toynbee, and so on. Sorry, Polly Neat. But for landlords, that then becomes an unattractive investment proposition. So this whole thing has become a real heated hot button topic. Where we are now is the government at last, having said many, many times that they're going to introduce the bill, then they've said they won't, then they want to tweak it, then they've done so and reintroduced it, and then pulled it again. I mean, it's been a real mess. We now have, and I think what my friend Ben Beadle at the National Residential Landlords Association is happy with, a compromise, which means that someone now will move in. They can't move out immediately. They obviously can still be evicted if they don't pay the rent. And that is, I guess, where we are. But there has been huge unnecessary and exaggerated sensationalism around this whole thing, as if tenants in Britain simply are beleaguered and kicked around. And that's not really true. We have to be careful, seriously, here.
I understand. It's important to introduce a note of caution. I absolutely get your point. I really do. But I think that many renters are caught between a rock and a hard place, because the reality is many working people obviously have in-work benefits, as one example, and so they will get housing benefit top-ups. But the truth is that most people, and I know this from the casebooks that I receive, most people who are in that position, they are struggling to meet their rental costs because private renting is so high. So should we actually have a cap, a ceiling?
No. Oh, my goodness, no. They try.
Russell can't bear that thought.
Well, only because, not because of any political ideology, Sonia, but because it's been proven not to work. It was introduced in Berlin a few years ago. And do you know what happened? And this is the unintended consequence of overly favouring tenant rights, if you want to put it that way, which is that if landlords see that that asset, as in buy-to-let properties, is now unattractive because they don't have the right yield anymore or control over their asset, they simply go and put their money elsewhere. They'll put it into classic cars or the stock market or gold or whatever. Because government, particularly in Britain, has successively failed to build enough homes, there's a massive, and I mean hundreds of thousands, of shortages of affordable homes. So the landlords here in Britain, in particular, are filling that gap. If you dissuade them from doing so and being in the buy-to-let market, they will simply leave the sector in droves. Then what do you end up with? A huge and even bigger shortage of rental property for those very renters that the government here is seeking to protect.
I take your point. And I think on that, we can absolutely agree. And that is our of a social housing stock is utterly depleted. And that is what we need to be building on. I think on that, you and I absolutely agree. Let's see if we can get any agreement on this story as well, Russell. And that is Rishi Sunak, our prime minister, is talking about this sick note culture. And apparently in a bid to overhaul the entire system, he is now going to, he talks about the over-medicalizing of people, but he is now going to remove the ability for GPs to be able to sign people off. What are your thoughts about this?
I have many thoughts on this. One is that this, I think, is again coming in, you know, good time, on the basis that this, I think, has been a problem for a long time. The stats, as I understand them, are that since the pandemic, an extra 700,000 people are signed off sick on long term. So not just sick for a few days, but long term sick, as in they cannot work, inverted commas. And the majority of those because of mental health issues. Now, I'm not going to denigrate mental health. I'm not going to say it doesn't exist. But I think it's fair to say that if over a 2 or 3 year period, an extra 700,000 people out of a population of 67 million decide to get themselves signed off by, and here's the other point, perhaps overly accepting and eager doctors, then I think it's fair to say, A, we have a problem because that costs money. So the bill now for those people signed off with mental health, I mean, the total is about £69 billion here, which obviously has to be paid for by the taxpayer. But I think we have an over-eager medical profession that 90%+ of the time, if you go to the doctor and say, hey, I'm feeling a bit anxious, I've got some depression, they will simply just sign you off. And of course, that has to be paid for, right? It costs the employer money, it costs the state money, and so on. So I think Rishi Sunak is right. But my other thought is that this government in Britain have been in power for 14 years. And it always makes me smile, but actually not in a funny way, actually in an ironic and rather depressing way, that a party that have been in power, and bearing in mind, I'm a former Conservative voter, so I'm not here to bash the Conservatives, Sonia, but those that lead the party now, that have been part of the cabinet for years and prime minister for 2 years or more, they are sounding a lot like people in opposition that are criticising the 14 years before them as if they had no part of it. So I think it's too little too late. I think there is a huge over-reliance on the system in terms of being very easily able to sign yourself off with the doctor's over-anxious help, over-enthusiastic help. And it's costing Britain dearly in productivity terms and in terms of state benefits. So in summary, Rishi's right. A, it's probably too late by a few years. But secondly, is he actually going to follow through with this? Bearing in mind he's only got probably 6 or 7 months of his administration left. Rishi Sunak and actually successive prime ministers before him, frankly, have a horrendous record of flip-flopping and deciding just to do the exact opposite of what they announced a few weeks previously. So do I have faith that Rishi Sunak's actually going to grab this problem by the scruff of the neck and solve it? No, I don't.
But Russell, isn't this just a continuation of what they started 10 years ago when they went after sick and disabled, David Cameron's coalition government with George Osborne under the welfare reform bill, and the attacks on very vulnerable people there took place? And it always feels like we're always demonizing those who are struggling, those more. And don't get me wrong, I know some people swing the lead. Absolutely. I agree with you. And I'm actually somebody who completely believes in work and the power of work and what we can get from it and how good it is for our mental health. But do you really think that the way to tackle people who are claiming they have serious mental health problems is to attack them further? Shouldn't we be looking at why perhaps they say they have mental health problems?
Well, look, you can always go back to the source, right? It's the same as, you know, why do youngsters stab each other on the streets of London? You know, we can go back to the fact there aren't enough ping pong tables and basketball courts in London. I mean, which I think is nonsense, by the way. So we can do that. But that doesn't solve the problem now. And if this continues at that rate of an increase over 3 years of 700,000 people now claiming to be off work because they are anxious, then where does this end up? I mean, if you extend that line in a linear way, we will end up in 10 years' time with loads more people off sick and not working than working. What happens to the economy? I'm not seeking to demonize those that have genuine and serious mental health issues. Of course, those people should be sympathized with. Of course, those people exist. But there are a significant number of people that are swinging the lead, playing the game, milking the system. We need to find a way of ensuring that that doesn't happen. And frankly, that's down to not just government, but civil servants and the NHS to make sure that they say no sometimes. You know, just because you don't like where you sit at work or you don't like your new boss, or your boss has made you work an extra half an hour some days to get work done, that doesn't mean you then have the right to be signed off work for 6 months at the cost to the state. We are way too eager as a nation here, and the Western society as a whole, as a consequence of what we've all got away with through the pandemic and lockdowns, we find it way too easy and ready to say, nah, I don't fancy working.
Oh, you mean the whole kind of furlough, work from home kind of thing? It got people into a certain mindset, right? And none more so, of course, than people who work in Whitehall. They don't even want to return to their offices.
Indeed. Do they? Don't even get me started on the public sector taking loads more days off sick than the private sector. That's absolutely true. Look, we are becoming a lazy sick note Britain. And someone needs to grab that and deal with it. And otherwise, we will end up not just being unproductive, we'll end up bankrupt. The people need to understand, if you're off work for 6 months, signed off because, you know, you don't like the way the plants have been potted in your office or whatever, I know that's a ridiculous example, but you take my point. That money that you are paid in state benefits has to come from somewhere, has to come from the taxation system, which is already overburdened. And your employer that might only have 10 or 12 employees, imagine having an extra two or three people off all of a sudden because you feel a bit weary, a bit tired, a bit anxious, a bit stressed with life because you've had an argument with your girlfriend over, I don't know, what your cat eats on a Thursday night, whatever. That simply isn't sustainable. We've got to start standing up and being a proper country again, haven't we?
I know, I understand. You're talking about developing some more of a backbone than we've had in recent times, right? But then we're being nannied to hell and back, aren't we? Synchronized Souls podcast says we need more support in mental health to keep people in work. Well, that would make sense, wouldn't it?
But is it going to solve the problem? I mean, all right, put it this way. Let's say we allocate an extra £10 billion of taxpayers' money to supporting people that say they have mental health issues. Do you think the next day that stops the work shy, the lazy, those that are gaming the system, from ringing in sick or going to the doctor and saying, oh, I feel terribly depressed and anxious over X? It won't stop that at all, because the work shy, given a system that allows them to game the system, will always be work shy. And I think we've got to stop being so woke. And I hate to use this phrase because it's so well worn and so, I don't know, so corny. Go woke, yeah. Go broke. It's so true. And we are halfway down that slippery slope, in my opinion.
Well, I mean, I'm interested, Russell, just out of my own curiosity, have you ever worked with anybody with mental health issues, like real mental health issues?
I don't know, because I don't pry in terms of what those individuals that I've worked with over the years, you know, might have right. going on in their lives. I've certainly had right. no one come to me and confide and say they've got mental health issues. I have to say, let me just use another example. I've worked in the private sector and the public sector. I was a councillor that used to have an office, my private office, about 100 yards away from the council offices. And I used to flit between the two on a daily basis. The difference in work culture between private and public sector is enormous. It's enormous. Also, show me of 10 CEOs or entrepreneurs, people that work from themselves, that have grafted and started their own business and so on. Show me the proportion of those that have had 6 months off with anxiety versus those that work in NHS management or in the Home Office that have been off for many months with anxiety. It cannot be true that if people are the same as in flesh and blood, that somehow in certain professions, particularly the public sector, we end up with a much, much higher disproportion of people that scream mental health. Many are gaming the system.
Oh, and on that note, aren't we glad that Russell is a property expert as opposed to a psychiatrist? Thank you so much, Russell Quirk, for joining us this morning. We'll see you the other side of the news.